This week in Retronauts, I ask you to use your imagination. Everyone, welcome. This was supposed to be a visual presentation, but for some reason, it's not working. So I'm going to ask you to visualize the things that we're talking about. It's a really great slideshow. We're going to have an awesome time up here. I hope the same can be said for you out there. Let's quickly introduce ourselves. Oh, look, it's such... I wish you could all see this. Maybe we should turn our backs to the audience and you guys can squint at the screen.
Like Michelangelo's David.
Yeah, exactly. It's wait, what? There's no nudity here. So this is Chrono Trigger, 30 years of the greatest RPG of all time. There's an asterisk after greatest because we refuse to commit. So we are, I'm Jeremy Parrish.
I'm Kevin Bunch.
I'm Ryan Clark.
And usually there is a pretty different Retronauts mix at this show, but everyone's scared to travel internationally right now for some reason. So it's us. You're stuck with the American folks. So let me present to you the question, what is Chrono Trigger? You've heard of it, right? Well, I'm going to give you a rundown anyway, otherwise we're not going to fill an hour. It's a Super NES role-playing game, debuted in 1996, published by Squaresoft at the end of the system's life, near the end of the system's life. It dragged on for a little while longer, but after this, that was kind of it. That was the last of the big shows, other than Yoshi's Island, Street Fighter Alpha 2. Originally, this game cost about $90, $80, $90. It was, you know, there's a lot of talk this week about the cost of next-generation games for Nintendo Switch, but I gotta say, Chrono Trigger was a time traveler, appropriate to the theme of the game, and looked forward ahead 30 years and said, we are gonna price ourselves like a 2025 game. And that was in 1990s dollars, which were very strong and powerful. And yet, I would argue that that game was worth every penny. I certainly paid that much. And I wrung $90 of entertainment out of it, and then some.
What extra chips are they putting on games these days?
Nice. You know, this didn't actually have any special, you know, extremely unusual chips in it. There was no Super FX. There was no... what's that?
RAM?
I mean, it was a big ROM, but it didn't have the chip that they used in Street Fighter Alpha 2 or anything like that. There was no, like, encoded data. There were no... you know, songs that had to be compressed, like in Star Ocean and so forth. So it was just a big honkin' game, and just, that's why it cost a lot.
Just the Toriyama tax, then.
Right. And it was $90. $90 for a game that was like 15 hours long. And yet, nevertheless, it is the greatest asterisk game RPG of all time. I have a little clip here which was going to be very funny and appeal to those of you who... like Mad Men. Let's see if you can hear the audio at least.
It's a nice sensation.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Don Draper. Thanks for leading in. All right. So, it's now talking time. And there's a funny graphic here of the guy from Clash of Demonhead going, ah, because it said talking time in the game. But you can't see that. Guys, when did you first play Chrono Trigger?
I'll let you go first.
I got it and Final Fantasy VI for the Expos the same Christmas, and so...
That was probably all your parents could afford to get you for Christmas.
It was the greatest Christmas I had until that point, and it will be the greatest Christmas that I have for the rest of my life.
It might be the greatest Christmas of all time.
Yes.
The greatest Christmas asterisk
yes.
of all time.
As for myself, I remember reading about it in Nintendo Power and thinking, wow, this game looks really cool. I don't know that I can afford it. And flash forward a few years to when I had a job in high school, and I was at the Gibraltar Trade Center in Michigan.
Woo!
See, someone else knows what it is. We were discussing this earlier. And at one of the booths there, someone was selling a boxed copy for $70, a whole $20 price cut. And I picked that up, and I played the absolute crap out of it for a couple of years straight.
That's a lot of Chrono Trigger. But it does lend itself to that kind of play. So myself, I bought it, I think, launch day. I pre-ordered it, and it was very, very expensive, so I traded in my copy of Final Fantasy III/6. I wasn't fortunate like Brian. I had to pay for it myself.
But
so
you got to play Final Fantasy VI sooner than I did.
That's true. I wrung the content out of that one, too. I played it like 3 times through and said, that's probably enough. I need to move on. So then Chrono Trigger, I bought and quit my summer job so that I could just sit around playing it. And then I didn't have any more money again. It's really great how it just kind of feeds itself. So here we go into the time warp, which if you could see, you'd be like, oh, Chrono Trigger graphics, but you can't. So the question is, why is it the greatest asterisk RPG of all time? You may well ask. And we're going to answer that. But generally speaking, the TLDR is the stars simply lined up, and it's just one of those things. It just was one of those games where everything fell into place and made it amazing. So point one, I've got a 10-point list here because everything, we think in terms of, you know, tens, decimals. It was created by the Dream Team. And that's not the Dream Team that Nintendo would tout a year later for Ultra 64. This was not about Crystal Dynamics, or no, Robotech Crystal Dreams made by Game Tech. That's
it. I was going to say, this isn't
about Game Tech here. No.
Midway.
Nope. The Dream Team in this case were Yuji Horii. There's a from Dragon Quest Rocket Slime, the Chrono Twigger Super Tank with a King Slime sitting on top. If you could see this, you would be like, that Jeremy Parrish, he put together a great presentation. Yuji Horii, of course, is the creative lead behind Dragon Quest since its beginning and continues to be. Someday we will see Dragon Quest XII, or even hints of what Dragon Quest XII is, and you'll be like, that Yuji Horii's back at it again. The rest of the Dream Team comprised Hironobu Sakaguchi and Yoshinori Kitase, who I have represented here with Mog and Umaro, as their most recent project had been Final Fantasy VI. Sakaguchi would kind of drift away from the games at this point and go on to make a movie, which was certainly a personal choice. And Yoshinori Kitase would make some of the most successful RPGs of all time with Final Fantasy VII, VIII, X, etc. But you have Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy combined here. Amazing. And finally, there is Akira Toriyama, who in this case is a frog-looking guy, because we don't know what he actually looked like. He never showed his face, so we just assume he looked like the king of the frogs that lived in Chrono Trigger.
He was Toriyama, the guy who was in Blue Dragon and Dragon Quest, the guy who wore the gas mask.
Yeah, he always wore a gas mask. We don't know.
Yeah, so could be anyone.
I mean, the frog is probably a disguise, too. But you have four highly respected industry veterans getting together, bringing two very different sensibilities to this game.
It really feels like this is where this was them at the height of their power, so to speak, too. Because we had Yuji Horii coming off of Dragon Quest V, and I think VI was coming out around the same time. Following up Final Fantasy VI with this is absolutely wild. And Toriyama finally got to take a break from drawing Dragon Ball for, you know, 10 years. So he got to sleep and rest and work on Chrono Trigger.
And you still had, well, I guess one active person with Shonen Jump, but one person formally, so you were still kind of feeding the Shonen Jump machine with this suit, with all its, like, promotional cycles that Dragon Quest had always benefited from up until now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you check my YouTube channel, I've got a video rip of a VHS tape that V-Jump magazine distributed just to promote Chrono Trigger before the game came out in Japan. And, you know, I paid a lot of money for that tape, and it was worth it. Just like Chrono Trigger itself. It's like, here's some kind of music that's a little off from the final version. That's such a great relic. How would you guys describe the difference between Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest? Because they do have very different creative ethos.
I feel like, for my money, Dragon Quest is willing to be a lot more traditional in terms of like mechanics and what you're actually doing, but it'll and the storylines as well. But they're also willing to be a lot sillier with, you know, character designs and enemy designs and the jokes, so to speak.
And like Final Fantasy is almost by its definition something different every time, right?
Yeah.
Whereas they never, I mean, I don't want to say never, but rarely would they ever take those kind of leaps with a Dragon Quest game. Like, one is inherently more experimental.
When they tried to make Dragon Quest IX a sort of action RPG, the outcry from fans was so powerful and profound that they actually went back and changed how the game worked. They changed the fundamental gameplay of Dragon Quest IX just because they realized this is not going to go well. So, yeah, people expect certain things from Dragon Quest, whereas Final Fantasy, people want things, but I think also they've learned at this point, like, who knows what Final Fantasy XVII is going to be like? It's anyone's guess. So point two for what makes Chrono Trigger the greatest asterisk RPG of all time is that it has a fantastic cast of characters. And I would say this is something that kind of shows the Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy combination together, because Final Fantasy is really good about giving you named characters who have motives and quests, but isn't always great at sort of building up an emotional connection to them. Sometimes it does. But a lot of times it doesn't. Whereas Dragon Quest, I think, is really about building an emotional connection, not just to your party, but to everyone you meet in the world. And I really feel like this is the game where they managed to really kind of combine that approach and make you really care a lot about the cast of characters. And part of that is the way they're written, but also it's because they are all distinct in combat, and they all work together in an interesting way in combat. And so it really kind of, you know, the characters work across the spectrum. And there are seven, playable characters. The main guy, his name is Chrono. You can tell he's not the real hero of the game because there's no H in his name. It's just C-R-O-N-O. Who is the real hero? That you may ask. I don't have the answer. Chrono doesn't really say anything. He says nothing except in one of the bonus joke endings. He likes cats. If you could see this presentation here, every time I click forward, a new cat appears around Chrono's portrait. It's a really great gimmick. I wish you could see it. He has cool hair. There's another cat. Extremely good in combat, and that's important because he's the guy you're stuck with most of the game, and he is extremely good at killing things. He's a good kid, but he's really good at killing stuff. You have Marl. Marley? Marl? It's Marl, but it should be Marley.
It's absolutely her real name. Don't worry.
So in the Japanese version, her name is Nadia? It's like she's...
In the US version, it's Nadia, yeah.
So her name is like short for Nadia that she goes by in the Japanese version. And they tried to do that with the English version. So she's Marl. But her real name is like Maraldia or something. It's not good. But she's the rebellious princess, and I would be too if my parents had named me that. There's a funny picture of Joffrey Baratheon here that says the seed is strong, because the game really kicks off in earnest when you travel back in time and you meet Marl's great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, who looks exactly like her. So like the Baratheons, or rather the Lannisters, honestly. They're blonde. There's just a likeness across the ages. And also, Marl is the moral center of the story. If it weren't for the fact that she cares about the lives of people she's never met, people who would live 1,000 years after she does, this game would go nowhere. It would just be like, well, okay, yeah, the future is really bad. Let's go back home and enjoy the time we have. No, she says, let's save the future. And that involves traveling back to caveman times for some reason. There's Luca, the genius inventor. She's the one who kind of actually sets the entire events into motion. because she's really, really good at inventing, but not so good that her time or her warp device doesn't undergo catastrophic mistakes and accidentally send royalty into the wrong time era. So everything happens from having to chase down the princess and save her in a different way than like a Mario saving the princess kind of way. Luca is also, I think, a really great character because she's sort of, in a way, the player's sort of window into caring about some of the characters who are added to the party later. Like, because of her compassion for Robo, a machine, like, you really want to adopt Robo into your party. And she's grossed out by Frog, but then decides, you know, Froggy, you're not such a bad guy after all, I think is what she says. And Frog, he is a frog. They named him creatively. I'm repping Frog here with my pins. Also my socks, but I'm not going to show you those. So he is a frog, and that is his secret burden. He is cursed. He's actually a very handsome young man named Glenn. But you don't get to see that except in one of the secret endings. So instead, you have to play with Frog the whole time. You can actually... So he's the one character where you get to make a moral choice beyond like, oh, we got to go save the world, which is forced on you. In this case, you can say, I'm going to let Frog get his revenge, or I'm going to recruit a really cool character. Now, you may think if he gets his revenge and breaks the curse, you get to play as Glenn the rest of the game, but you don't. You're still stuck as Frog until the ending. So what I think it just proves that revenge leads to nothing, leads to nowhere.
They weren't going to animate a whole new set of sprites just for that. I mean, they might have. This game is wild.
So, additionally, you have Robo, who is, yes, a robot. Much like Generation Alpha, he is born in a post-apocalyptic world. And Robo is a great character because he's a mechanical character. He's a robot. And so, therefore, he has a unique relationship with both magic and with time. One of the things about Robo is that he can't cast magic like the rest of the party can because he's a robot and, you know, he doesn't have midichlorians or whatever. But also, there's a really cool side quest where you take advantage of the fact that he is a machine who will basically live forever if, you know, maintained properly and are like, hey, go live through a time loop for 600 years and save this forest. And he does it because he's a robot and he does what you tell him to. There's also Ayla, who actually, she's a human and she doesn't have magic, but that's because she was, I guess, born before midichlorians.
I guess.
She's an awesome cave woman. You should not mistake her for some other awesome time-traveling cave woman, and I've got a picture of Leela from Doctor Who here that you can't see, but she's cool. She's got a knife. Ayla doesn't need a knife. She uses her fists, and it still makes her the strongest character in the game because she is from a time before people learned to pull their punches. She's a woman of little grammar and littler clothing. And finally, spoiler alert, Magus. If you haven't played this game, you should leave the room about 30 seconds ago. Magus is the conniving evil villain, but if you choose not to kill him with Frog in an optional event, he will join the party. Is he a hero? Maybe, but he is central to the storyline, the main plot line that involves a big like hedgehog from space. I've got a picture of Guile, not from Street Fighter, from Chrono Cross here. Magus may be the only character who actually returns to be playable in Chrono Cross, but the creators were very cagey about that and didn't do anything with it, so who knows. And Magus is interesting because he's very powerful, but he's an outsider and doesn't have the simpatico and the synergy with the main cast. So if you want to maximize his abilities in battle, you have to make sacrifices. You have to give up accessory slots in your inventory, which are very precious and do cool things, if you want him to be able to like really, really team up with your party and blow the bad guys away. You got to make some tough choices.
He only has triple attacks or something.
No, he only has magic and he can do dual attacks. But to do triple attacks, you have to equip a special thing, and it's specific to each of the techs. So it's not like you can just give him an ornament that lets him triple attack with everyone. It's like this ability, give up your item slot to cast one really powerful spell with everyone else. So do you guys have a favorite character?
I feel like I go back and forth, but I feel like Ayla ends up in my party all the time just because she wallops everything so hard.
even though he's a little fiddly to use, like Jeremy said, it's Magus. The scene where you're fighting him, going up to that castle, winning that battle, that's... He could not be my favorite character at
that battle. That battle's insane.
All the characters have themes, their own theme music, but his theme is the best. It's like spooky, epic combat music, and that's his like character theme. That's cool. I'm kind of with you, Kevin. I really like Ayla mainly because of her utility in combat. She's got a great double attack with dual attack with Chrono, where she hits everything in a straight line across the screen because he just chucks her. He's like, "Go for it, Cave Woman." It's the fastball is special. She's Wolverine, and it's awesome.
She does have that Wolverine energy. It's true. She might even be short like Wolverine.
No, I don't think so.
You think Ayla's really tall?
Is she Canadian like Wolverine?
She lives in primordial Canada. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Before they had drawn the boundaries. So the third point in what makes Chrono Trigger so good, we're dawdling, we need to move faster. We were just talking about this, it's got a great combat system. In a sign of impressive confidence, Square called this the Active Time Battle 2 system. They said, this is the Final Fantasy battle system, but the next one, it's twice as good. And they were correct. It's kind of got the real-time turn-based thing seen in Final Fantasy. And here I've got a sample video of combat. Which, that doesn't do you any good. So we're just going to skip right ahead. I'm gonna. If you are a Retronauts patron, I'm going to put this keynote up on the Patreon. So when this episode goes up, you'll be able to see this presentation that I spent about 5 hours putting together. And you're going to say, wow, that was a real waste of time, Jeremy Parrish. So the thing about combat in that makes this 2.0 and not just Active Time Battle 1... it's not just about the real-time turn-based thing, but also the placement of your characters, their positioning on screen, has a huge impact on how the battle flows and what options you have available to you. Whereas in Final Fantasy, everyone just lines up and just takes turns running across the screen to hit a guy. Here, everyone's all over the place, and you have to kind of look and see, you know, what abilities do I have available right now, and how do they impact enemies? How do they work relative to my position, enemies' positions, and so forth? Basic attacks, you know, you choose to stab someone, you're going to run over to stab them. If you choose Luca to shoot someone, she's just going to shoot from where she stands. But when you use techs, those are generally proximity-based, whether it's based on an enemy's location and maybe there's like an area of effect or an area of effect based on where you attack from. Or like I said, you know, Ayla has the one that just goes straight across the line. These all are kind of spur-of-the-moment decisions you have to make. You have to kind of take into account the palette of abilities available to you at any given moment and where you are relative to the enemies. And that's really, really interesting and keeps combat constantly fresh and varied from battle to battle. There's another video here where the people are fighting. Good music, at least.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. on top of that, there's the elemental system, which Chrono Cross really built up, maybe a little too much. But every character has their own innate affinity, fire, ice, water, light, shadow. And you can build a team with complementary abilities, so like a really well-balanced team is Chrono and Marl and Luca, because you've got lightning, you've got ice, and you've got fire. But you can just say, I don't want a balanced team, I want a team that's really cool, and pick the three shadow-based characters, Ayla, Robo, and Magus, and leave yourself very vulnerable to certain enemies and kind of useless against others, but that's a pretty cool team, so maybe it's worth it. Oh, more combat. So here I have a a video of Luca fighting Son of the Sun. She's a fire-based character. He's a fire-based enemy. Will it work out? Were they meant for each other? I don't know. You'll have to watch the keynote when I post it to Patreon. Find out. And then finally, on top of the text, you have combos. Instead of being called magic spells, it's called text, like techniques, I guess, or technologies and Robo's case, I don't know. But you can combine these texts into combos. You can have two characters team up and use a combined attack, or in many cases, once you learn the basic abilities required, you could have three characters, all three characters on screen at once, team up. And this is a really great system because, one, the combo texts are just existing single character texts combined. So it's not like you have to learn special abilities. It's, you know, your characters combining their abilities in an interesting way, and all the dual texts kind of build off of that. Like, Chrono has an ability where he can just spin around with a sword and hit things. But if you're teaming up with Luca or with Marl, they can cast an elemental force on your sword while you're doing the spin. And so, hey, voila, you're hitting them with magic and with melee attacks. So you're hitting them for twice as much damage. It's a really, really neat and well-designed system. And you know that you also have the triple text, which are the same thing. So the challenge with text, the downside, is that it does tie up your characters. It's not like one character says, I'm using a triple attack. When you do that, all three characters have to commit for that entire turn. So there's kind of an opportunity cost. So again, it's, you know, in battle, you're always making these kind of spur-of-the-moment decisions and kind of doing these trade-offs and deciding what's going to happen, how am I going to approach this, how am I going to play this. And, oh, here's a cool triple tech against Lavos.
Yeah.
Oh, well. speaking of what you just heard, this game had an awesome soundtrack. It was created by Yasunori Mitsuda, who loves Celtic music but restrained himself here to go more fusion jazz prog. And it has some contributions by Nobuo Uematsu of Final Fantasy because Mitsuda kind of worked himself sick and was sleeping under his desk for a while and eventually had to tap out. And Uematsu stepped in and covered for him.
You could be forgiven for not knowing that this is Mitsuda at all. I feel like if you listen to more modern stuff, because it's very Celtic.
It is, but you know, there are some other game soundtracks that he's done that kind of cross the threshold between the jazz prog style of Chrono Trigger and, you know, the Celtic style that you get in Chrono Cross, really. Actually, Chrono Cross is a good combination of those. There's a lot of that in there, yeah. I mean, I think it's a testament to Chrono Trigger's soundtrack that it's the first video game to inspire an acid jazz fusion remix soundtrack called Brink of Time. If you've never heard it, it's got scrambled eggs on the cover for some damn reason. I don't know. But it will scramble your brain because it's acid jazz fusion. Like, video games can do this? It's amazing. Do you guys have any particular favorite standout bits of the soundtrack?
You know, we talked about Magus' theme earlier, and that's always been one of my favorites. It's so good. And the way it, like, builds as you go through it. Perfect for a big epic fight against who you'd think is a final boss but isn't.
Yeah, and also it has really great character themes. Oh my god. It's the first video game to Rickroll you. Trigger is the peak of Super NES technology. I mean, there are some more advanced games. I mentioned the compressed song in, I think, Tales of Phantasia and Star Ocean 2. You know, Street Fighter Alpha 2 is basically a PlayStation game with a few dropped frames and a lot of load times. But in terms of just a seamless experience, Chrono Trigger is about as good as it gets. Do you guys argue against that?
No, I would definitely call this, what, a top three, like, most impressive Super NES game just across the board.
All right, what's the other... What's the other two? Come on, I'm putting you on the spot.
Put me on the spot, huh? Well, I am always going to go to bat for Super Mario RPG. I just like the music and the art style in that one a lot, too. And, oh, God. What would be number three? Oh, no. I'll just say Yoshi's Island. That's a good lazy choice.
Good. Yeah, that system really peaked at the end, I would say.
I'll wake up at 2 a.m., you know, in a cold sweat, like, oh, I should have mentioned that other game.
There's always social media to address your errors.
Exactly. I mean, I think this is definitely the most technically impressive Super NES game that most people have played, if nothing else. Because some of those other ones, like, you can get into, I'm blanking on the one I was trying to think of before this, but yeah, if you look at, like, Star Ocean and things like that, it's like, that never even came here.
And it was like $150 in Japan. It was no one bought that. It's nuts.
Rendering Ranger, I guess, maybe. That's another impressive one.
That has gotten a reissue very recently.
At long last.
So yeah, we mentioned the fact that Chrono Trigger sounds great, and this clip you can actually enjoy. Well, aside from the sound effects. But I mean, what great music.
How could this not have been an acid jazz album? I ask you.
Like, that doesn't sound like any other video game soundtrack of that era, ever, at all. It's so different and so distinct, and it sounds so good.
And it was his breakout, too, which is the crazy part. It's not that he'd never done any sound work before that, but he was never, like, this was his first soundtrack that he largely scored himself. And, like, what did he do?
Yeah, this game looked great. I've got a really cool image here of the courtroom scene. I don't have to show it to you because you know it by heart. It's so good. And also that ties into the music because Mitsuda just totally said, you know what would be really cool? The trial music from Pink Floyd's The Wall. I'm just going to put that here. Chrono Trigger is actually not that big a game. If you look at the map, which you can't do because it's not on the big screen, but there aren't that many places to go in the world. But you're crisscrossing back and forth between times, so there's added depth and layering to each of the limited locations that you can go to. And I think the small scale of the game is important. The small size that was possible for a game that looked and sounded this good on, you know, within the limitations of an NES ROM, because it gave the creators hard boundaries that they had to fit into. And that would go away the next generation with PlayStation. And I think kind of sometimes to these very creators' detriment, they got a little carried away. And I've got a photo, an image here of Dragon Quest VII, someone hunting for a tiny metal. If you know, you know. But Chrono Trigger is just right. And there's a little sprite of Marl cheering right here. She agrees. So point six in what makes Chrono Trigger... Ooh, tongue-tied. Giving away next year's talk. What makes it so great is that it makes maximal use of the time travel concept. I feel like there had probably been some games about time travel before this. I think there was a game called Time Twist on Famicom Disk System. Surely there were... Someone's played it and apparently regrets it. Okay, so... Yeah, I feel like there had been some time travel games, but nothing like this, where time travel is baked into the concept and they really just make the most out of it. It sets up the premise by just kind of letting you goof around for a while at the Millennial Fair, and then it starts to drop story at you and pulls you in bit by bit until you're really engaged and you know, you want to see what's happening. There's some mystery to it, and then it starts to resolve, and just when you start to figure things out, oh, you end up in another time zone altogether and the world's over. That's a great escalation, I would say. And then, you know, once it kind of built up the concepts and stakes and kind of gives you a clear picture of how did this happen, what's all behind this, it sort of just sets you free to resolve the crisis at hand kind of on your own steam. And you never have to wonder why the story matters because it's laid out very clearly. Humanity is going to be stuck in a little bunker eating nothing, just always being hungry and sad and wearing gloomy gray clothing. So there's, you know, there's a clear mission, but you know what you need to do. You figure that out, and you have a lot of freedom in how to go about it. And along the way, there are lots of interesting set pieces, like the trial I mentioned, and then that gets kind of an echo through time later on. Just lots of great self-referential elements, and it just feels like, you know, nothing is wasted.
I was gonna say it.
Oh, that's right, there's a race, yeah. If you could see my screen, I've got a little clip of a Johnny cartoon up here, but again, sadly, no.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of, like, Dragon Quest III, how two-thirds of it is very, like, linear, and then you get into the part where you can just sort of do whatever you want in whatever order to make your way to the final boss. And Chrono Trigger's kind of the same way, even though it doesn't really feel like it's really, like, directing you, which is what is so really impressive about it. You go to these different time periods, feel like, oh, I can just wander around, do whatever. But, like, there is a very specific chain of events. But once you get to a certain point in the story, it's like, okay, go nuts, do what you're going to do.
You kind of had that with, like, Final Fantasy VI, too. But
yeah.
Obviously, you didn't get to travel through time.
And... No, you were stuck in the apocalypse there.
Yeah.
So the thing about Chrono Trigger is that, you know, the game is kind of broken not into locations, but also eras. And each era contains a character. Pretty much every era that you go to, there is a character that you can recruit into your party. Every era has its own kind of story element or concept that it puts forward. I've got a photo or a screenshot of Inhaza here, the city of dreams, where people are musing, you know, pretentiously about fate and predestiny. Each era contains a link back to the main plot, which of course involves the space hedgehog that's sleeping and dreaming, you know, kind of like Cthulhu, but spikier. And with an alien duck or something inside. I'm not really quite clear how that works. But, you know, there's something in each era that ties back to the central story. At the same time, each era also has an ambitious kind of minor villain who isn't necessarily related to the main storyline, but is sort of seizing on the chaos of the situation to grab power or wealth or something. And so you have to kind of resolve these problems in each time era, in addition to solving the overarching story. And again, that's something that's very, very Dragon Quest. I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that.
It is very Dragon Quest.
Okay. Time travel is constantly growing more convoluted and more expansive as you play through the game. It's kind of like in a Metroidvania where you gain new navigational abilities. This is not a Metroidvania, but you gain new means for traveling through time. Like initially, it starts out, there's just gates that take you from one era to another. And then when you get a fourth party member, you go to the end of time because there's a guy there who's like, oh, you can't time travel with that many people. That's against the rules. and then you get a time machine that just sits there. Kind of like H.G. Wells' time machine. The world, you know, changes around it, but it's not going anywhere. But then later, you put wings on the thing, and it lets you fly around through time and space, much like a TARDIS. So many of the story details span multiple eras. There are characters who have legacies that continue on through the ages. There are collectibles that you need to pick up in one era and do something with in another era. There are certain collectibles where you can pick them up in an early era, but if you don't, if you just touch them but don't actually take them, they'll power up over time. And if you go back later in the game to a future time era, there'll be like an enhanced version of the item you could have gotten. So there's that kind of fun risk-reward. It works really well here. It's not, I think they took this idea for Final Fantasy XII and that spear that you were supposed to, like the ultimate spear, yes, and did a terrible job with it, and it makes many people angry. But yeah, the final chapter of the game is, it constitutes a huge chunk of your playtime, and it's a totally free-form opportunity to just travel through time, figure out, like, as I think Gaspar says, someone close to you is in trouble or has a problem, go solve this before defeating Lavos. But you don't have to. You could just go beat up Lavos, the space hedgehog. So it's kind of up to you, like, how deep do you want to get into this game? So point seven is that every inch of this game feels thoughtfully crafted. Like I said, there's a picture of Die Hard here. It says, like a great 80s blockbuster, there's not an ounce of fat on this game. It's like a John McTiernan movie, where it's just like every bit of dialogue, every character, every incidental thing that shows up on screen matters in some way. And maybe that's a little too scripted and cute, but it makes for a damn good game experience.
It's the video game equivalent of a tight 90.
Yes, a tight 15.
Yeah.
It's just 15 hours, not 15 minutes. Yeah, Chrono Trigger does a great job of introducing its characters, the skills they have, the time travel concepts, and then building on those to become increasingly more complex. There are no random encounters in Chrono Trigger. That's a great thing that so few RPGs picked up on. But anytime you get into a battle, someone sat down and said, where should this battle take place? How should it be telegraphed? And how should the screen layout be arranged? How should you face the enemies? So there's kind of, you know, it should feel limiting, I think, but it doesn't. It feels like it's just really well curated, and it just creates this constant sense of, you know, this battle was set up for me to challenge in a different way, and it's going to differ according to which characters I'm using. And it's just very, very thoughtful and it's very well appreciated. You just didn't get that in other RPGs of the era. Basic foes and bosses alike require an understanding of play mechanics and the tactics available to you at any given moment. And even the characters like the New and Johnny end up having an important role in the story. And you can't see this, but there was a video that VJump put out that has like a 20-minute animation based on Chrono Trigger, but it's not Chrono and gang. It takes place at the Millennial Fair, but it's Johnny and a New and one of those little fuzzy Kilwalla guys, and they're just having goofy misadventures at the Millennial Fair. And so there's yeah, I think it actually gave it like written lyrics and yeah. Yeah, again, you'll have to see that on Patreon. But it's the fun sort of lighthearted jump content to Dragon Chrono Trigger. Jeez, we are running low on time. Let's just say there's a lot of optional content. You don't have to complete the side quests to work here, but it helps. Side quests can be tiny things like giving objects to people in different time eras, or huge like leaving Robo to till a field for 400 years. But everything you do, every optional part you take, you know, you partake of, it has benefits. And you can collect so many cats.
Feel bad for Chrono's mom.
I put 2 8s in here, so it's actually 11. No, there's a lot of replay value to this game, thanks to New Game Plus. Had you guys ever seen anything like New Game Plus before outside of like Zelda's Second Quest, which isn't the same thing?
I think this is the first game that I've actually seen it call that New Game Plus.
But the idea of beating the game and then carrying over, like Metroid did that, but I can't think of anything else that did that, especially not like a large-scale adventure like this. The idea, you know, when you play an RPG, you want to build up from zero, but this game is like, hey, you beat the game, you don't need to start from zero, you can keep all your weapons and all your levels, just have fun. Like, what's the point of doing that? Well, Chrono Trigger gives you a point. You can max out your stats and basically be as gods, as they said in Xenogears. But basically, the New Game Plus makes it painless to go back and find, as the developer room comment says, 10 different endings to explore all the different permutations of time travel. And, you know, really kind of the big question is, what happens if you beat the final boss before you resolve all these little stories on the side? And it turns out a lot of times you do not get a happy ending. It's not like a bad, horrible ending, but maybe everyone's a reptile. Or, you know, maybe the girls are just sitting around ogling Glenn and Chrono's getting jealous. I don't know. But that's what happens if you jump ahead.
You know, who among us, though?
Fair enough. So yeah, the New Game Plus just gives you the opportunity to do things that you think, it would be cool if I could try this, but it's probably not possible. But eventually, you can become strong enough that it is in fact possible to beat Lavos in the Kingdom of Zeal long before the final battle. And instead of Chrono dying, spoilers, you just, you know, go to the developer's ending and Hironobu Sakaguchi's like, nice work. And we have just have a couple minutes, but I do want to give kind of the final point that makes Chrono Trigger amazing, which is that even the DS remake was amazing. And that was not always the case. Game Boy Advance, DS remakes of games from the Super NES era were often troubled by washed out graphics, bad sound, cropped visuals, emulation errors, etc., etc. Final Fight 1, too cramped. I don't care if you can play as Guy. It's too cramped. Yeah, the Final Fantasy Advance remakes were pretty kind of rough to look at and rough to listen to. But not Chrono Trigger. Yasunori Mitsuda actually collaborated with the developers at Tosei to guarantee that it sounded correct and had a great interface. And on top of that, they added some new content, and they brought in all the material from the PlayStation version, like the FMVs, to introduce characters. They just crammed everything that they could into that DS card. Admittedly, sorry, there was a video there, but you don't get to see it. Admittedly, the village building side quest is maybe too much. You can skip that. It's not essential. It's there, but don't do it. So in summary, Chrono Trigger rules. Thank you. Guys, any final thoughts on Chrono Trigger?
The DS, if I remember, the DS remake is the basis for the one that's available on Steam and everything, the Pixel Remaster, so that's a great way to play it.
Yes, you can go out to the show floor right now and buy a copy of Chrono Trigger for $600, but you don't have to. You can get it on Steam, I think, for like $10.
Yeah. Nice.
Any other thoughts, Brian?
No.
Okay. Well, there you go. Thank you and good night. Appreciate everyone coming here. Kevin and I are going to be running over to the bonus stage like immediately to give some presentations. And then at 6 o'clock, right outside the vendor hall, there's a book signing, I think, with all of us.
Yep.
So if you have any of our books or would like to buy some of our books and have us deface them, we're available to do that. So thank you all for coming out. Thanks for bearing with us, despite the fact that my computer did not do what it was supposed to do. And I hope you have a great time, and go play some Chrono Trigger. I want to play some Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. Hello. If you are here, congratulations. You're about to have your mind blown. Just kidding. I make no such promises. We're going to talk about some video games and some game videos. Sometimes when people say game tapes, talking about video game cartridges, they're being ironic. But we are actually going to talk about game tapes because something that I have become kind of obsessed with in the past few years is the booming market that existed in Japan in the late 80s and early 90s for VHS cassettes and even Laserdiscs about video games. And this was a thing that did not really exist here. Someone at the Chrono Trigger panel was kind enough to bring this to me and give it to me to add to my pile of things that I'm ripping and uploading to YouTube. This is a VHS of Steel Gunner, an arcade game by Namco. It looks like it also has the soundtrack on here, because it's a Laserdisc, and you could do that kind of crazy shenanigans with a Laserdisc. This market that existed almost exclusively in Japan was really, I think, a sign of the times, sign of the times, as Prince would have said. It was a period of immense wealth and discretionary spending, and so many things emerged in Japan in the late 80s that people could spend their money on according to their discretion. And that included VHS tapes and Laserdiscs that just consisted of gameplay stuff, video game footage.
Yeah, I mean, this was the same era that had a lot of, like, video game soundtrack CDs and cassettes and records coming out, so it's really all part of the same culture. Like, people really like video games. They really like video game media outside of just playing the games.
And I feel like this is kind of difficult to explain to people here. Like, this thing existed until you put it in terms that kind of relate to the way things exist now, which is that these were basically long plays that you would find on YouTube or like LP Archive or something that you could purchase. And it made sense in a way because most of these things were of arcade games. And those were experiences that you could only have if you went to an arcade and put a lot of money in. And bear in mind that in Japan, arcade games did not cost 25 cents. They cost 100 yen, which was actually like $1.25 in dollars at the time. So, you know, the experience of playing an arcade game, one, besides being a location-based hassle, was also pretty expensive. So if you wanted, you know, the essence of Outrun or, God, there's so many, like, there's entire tapes breaking down the characters of King of Fighters 97. Like, if you wanted to have those arcade experiences at home and could not afford an arcade machine, which is very likely, you could buy one of these tapes, which were usually like 6,000, 8,000 yen, which, you know, not cheap, but still much cheaper than buying an arcade machine.
And, you know, like a long play, you could get an idea of how to play through the game yourself that way.
And, yeah, I've got some sample footage up here. Here is a Laserdisc called Namco Girls Island, or Gals Island, and the premise that this hangs on is that this is games by Namco that have women in them. Not necessarily women protagonists, as you see here with Dragon Spirit, where you play as a dragon, but they justify putting it here because at the end, the princess gives you a hug when you save her. And so this is a compilation of just game footage. Here's Marken Maze by Namco, which is like, what if Alice in Wonderland were playing Zaxxon? That's kind of how I would describe this. But, you know, it does have a female protagonist, so she belongs on Gal's Island.
This puts a lot of context together for me for, like, some of the Game Center CX weirder segments.
Yeah, there were a few companies that really, really kind of dug deep into this. This is Ordine, which I guess that's a young woman piloting the little craft blowing up the space duck. Here's Phelios, where you play as, I believe, Heracles or Perseus. Perseus. You kill Medusa, and hey, there's a lady, she's been captured, but she's there, so it's going on Gal's Island. And, you know, someone paid 5,000 yen, 60 bucks, for this VHS tape. Okay, that's enough, Phelios. There we go. All right. And this actually justifies it. Here's The Legend of Valkyrie, where you play as a Valkyrie and what is this? She like a kappa?
I think so.
Some sort of little critter, but... Yeah, so...
Yeah, it looks right.
So this wasn't like a full long play. This was just excerpts of this. But it's like a 30-minute video about Namco games that have females in them. That does not include Ms. Pac-Man because that was not a Namco game. And if you mention it to Namco, they get very upset. But the thing that's really, I found really fascinating is that there were two very specific kinds of videos that were distributed as part of this model beyond just like the Let's Play type stuff. One of those, which we're not covering here, were video game magazines. For a period of about 2 years, there were two competing monthly magazines released on VHS tapes, Famimaga Video, which was tied into Family Computer Magazine, and something called Game Tech Video, which was not tied to an existing publication and was published by Sony, and is actually pretty weird, but if you were really into Famicom and PC Engine and Mega Drive in like late 1988 through early 1990, you could get your previews and footage, you know, like your hype and reviews and tips and tricks by watching a VHS tape that was distributed pretty cheaply, like 2,000 yen a piece. So, you know, like maybe three or four times as much as a magazine, but like that's a real way to get these video game experiences pumped right into your eyeballs instead of as, you know, photographs of the screen. So it's kind of this cool little market. But what we're talking about this time, very briefly, is the fact that this little corner of the video store sort of, I would say, pioneered the concept of video game history, of documenting video game history and creating retrospectives, which we're talking like 1989, 1990. That just wasn't a thing that existed in most people's minds. What little video game history writing you saw at the time was something like Game Over by David Sheff, which was much more a meditation on business and presented as, hey, this evil corporation from Japan is brainwashing your children. Here's the story behind their evil schemes. It was very, very focused on business, not about the games, but there were several series, including the one we're looking at here, called The History of Video Games, or Video Game Museum, I believe.
Something like that.
That just said, let's look at the chronicles of video games as they existed and look at the works of individual companies. So that is what we're going to be exploring here. And these were published by a company called Pony Canyon, which you may know if you own any anime soundtrack CDs or if you are familiar with FCI, which was the American version of Pony Canyon and published lots of iffy NES games.
They're very prolific. I think
they were,
now.
But they were very on top of this, and they collaborated with a company called Cytron and Art, which I don't know where the name comes from exactly, but Cytron and Art also published video games. There was a Famicom Disk System game, a very pioneering music video game, like a musical shooter called Otoki, that came out in like 1987, 88, by Cytron and Art. So this company was kind of offbeat and interesting. And they put together this TV game museum series. I think there were at least three different series. This one is Taito. It goes through the history of Taito games up through about 1983. Then there's also Namco. And I've also seen a Capcom one, but that cost like $80. And I said, maybe that's more than I want to spend on retrospectives of old Capcom games.
This one's really impressive because it's very hard to find footage of like these 1970s Taito games in particular, and like it's very clean off of these.
Yeah, so these videos were narrated by George, I believe George Tanaka, who is a pretty well-known, went on to be a pretty well-known voice actor. At this point, he didn't really have much of a name for himself, but soon after this, he would voice Alucard in Helsing, I believe. He was in Gundam. He was in Serial Experiments Lane, Cowboy Bebop. He voiced Megatron in Transformers Cybertron. So here he's kind of getting his start in the business by telling you about what these old Taito games were. But as Kevin said, these are pre-microchip.
Microprocessor games.
Right, so these are all vacuum tube games, and they're very hard to find now, but they did a great job of giving context to this, showing the cabinets, the controls, the gameplay. They would do lots of close-ups of gameplay footage. So with Interceptor here, you get, you know, kind of the full-screen view of what the game actually looks like in action, filmed directly off the screen very cleanly. And then they would go for these sweet-ass scanline close-ups, so good, that kind of show you exactly what was happening with the action. And I actually am not familiar with a lot of older Taito stuff. So watching these Laserdiscs, this was a two-part Laserdisc series, and I believe that each one sold for about $75 for 30 minutes of content. Pretty expensive, but it's educational. I didn't pay that much. Here we've got Western Gun, which was not a microprocessor game in Japan, but when Midway imported it, I believe, they said, why don't we put this on a microprocessor? So it's kind of a... Oh, here's... Crap, I can't remember what this one is called. Do you know, Kevin?
Oh, not off the top of my head.
But this footage is awesome because this is one of those projection-type reflection games like Space Invaders, and they show that here, too.
Speak of the devil.
And, you know, because you're getting it real filming off-screen, you're seeing how kind of like the structure of the screen worked, what the graphics actually looked like, how they interacted with the backgrounds and the you know, the kind of the printed element that was back behind the glass. So it really, you know, at this point, I don't think anyone in Japan needed to be told what Space Invaders was or how it worked or looked. But as a bit of documentation, this is really fantastic stuff. And this was being made in 1990. Like, this is really good historical curation that just, like, there was nothing equivalent to this in the U.S. We had video game tips and tricks, I think, and GamePro video, and that was all just hype. It was like, here's how you beat Shredder in TMNT, or, you know, here's the secret to suffering through the adventures of Tom Sawyer, that kind of thing. And it was all just focused on NES games. Nothing about Master System, nothing about arcade games. This just didn't exist. But here they are, Citron and Art and Pony Canyon, just busting out actual video game documentation for, like, the ages.
Of, like, old games that are not commercially, like, relevant or viable at this point. Especially in Japan, where, you know, they were very interested in the new hot arcade games.
Yeah, I mean, at this point you had things like the Astro City, you know, the idea of interchangeable systems. You had, I mean, this was 1990, so you had the MVS coming out from SNK.
Yeah.
Famicom, you know, the Versus system, I think, existed there in some capacity. So the idea that video games were interchangeable, disposable, like you swap them out in arcades as soon as they stop being interesting and something better comes along that you can just plug into the socket, this fights against that. This is, you know, this is saying, like, hey, here's a machine that you're not going to see anywhere. This is, you know, 15 years old. Here's
Booty Balloon, I think this one is.
Yeah, Crazy Balloon.
Crazy Balloon.
Yeah, Taito had a brief fling with balloons, because you also get Balloon Bomber as the very next game. But here's George Tanaka telling you about Balloon Bomber.
Well, look, even got the like the flyer and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing I can really think about is that, like, in the U.S. you might get some magazine articles now and then, or occasionally a book might have a chapter or so about really old games that you might still see around occasionally in, like, the early 80s, but
yeah.
Nothing, you know, that late.
And definitely nothing so game, like, individual title specific. You know, I mentioned Game Over, but really kind of the first, like, hey, let's tell an exhaustive history of the video game industry in print was Lenny Herman's Phoenix books. And those are extremely business focused. You know, I've said this before. I've talked about this when I started working in the games press in 2003 at 1UP.com. I carved myself a niche just writing about old games for the retro section that had no content in it when the site launched. Because that content, like, no one was writing that kind of stuff. In the press, in magazines, like Kevin said, you would get, you know, EGM and the back page would have, you know, a single page about some relatively old game, or every once in a while they'd do, like, the top 100 video games of all time. But it was hard to find that kind of stuff in the West. And, you know, we had to go and create it ourselves because we wanted to see it. So I'm really envious of people who had 70,000 or 7,000 yen to spend and lived in Japan and could understand what George Tanaka was saying in 1990, because they were way ahead of the curve.
I'll just put it this way. The other day I was going through Ralph Baer's papers at the Smithsonian, and he has printouts of websites that had written articles about early video games because there were that few at the time. Oh, wow, Frontline.
So, Frontline, kind of an ignominious end for Taito here. I think we saw Quicks. Oh, no, we've got Elevator Action. So we end on a happy note. Elevator Action was 1982, so this is where this series cuts off, Elevator Action. That's the end. And then we go on to the second volume, the second series, which is about Namco. And I feel like this is much less of a digging through obscurity and finding weird, crazy things, because Namco's done a really good job of sort of curating its own past. You know, they put out Namco Museum in 1995 on PlayStation, and I kind of feel like the museum sort of presentation that you're seeing here, the 3D CG that's super primitive that Citron and Up put together, like, that was sort of the foundation of Namco Museum and its visual style and presentation. Of course, Citron and Art didn't give you, like, the virtual desk clerk. Well, no, you had the robot lady who would like say, you know, welcome, let me tell you about Namco's video games. But, you know, I don't think there are any big surprises on Namco's thing. I don't know if this one, QDQ, has shown up on any collections in the U.S., but for the most part. Yeah, I think it was on, like,
I think it was on
two.
A Wii one or something in the U.S. I know it's on the Japanese version of Volume 2.
So, yeah, then you got this guy, Pac-Man. Going to skip ahead through the good stuff. King and Balloon. I think this one was only on the Japanese Namco Museum Encore, which I imported and was like, what in God's name is this game? It's absolutely wild.
Yeah, I think they popped on some another Pac-Man game for the U.S. one there instead.
Yeah, you've got Tank Battalion. You've got Rally X, the game that they thought was going to be popular, more popular than Pac-Man, but wasn't. Although that was probably more Midway thinking that than Namco.
I feel like everybody thought that, but... Oh man, Warp.
And Warp, yep. Warp and Warp, I didn't get all the footage on here, but Warp and Warp is interesting because after you beat this round, you go to a round that's basically Bomberman, several years before Bomberman existed. I feel like Namco puts up a better showing than Taito, probably because they started up later and didn't have as many of the vacuum tube games, the TTLs. So you get stuff like Galaga and Bosconian, which has a radar and everything. Pretty great. Of course, this being a Japanese video, there you go. They basically got a full, like, you can tell. It's got basically a full walkthrough of an entire round of Zevius.
I want to know if the advertising for this specifically talked about how much Zevius was on here.
I never saw the ads for it, but you do get a big old chunk of Zevius on here. And, you know, Mappy, of course. We don't get Ms. Pac-Man, but you do get Pac and Pal. Libble Rabble, Gapless, and of course, they take you to the very end of Tower of Draga. Like, this is actually someone showing off. Like, look at all the power-ups they've got down there at the bottom. Get out of the way. What? There we go. Yeah, look at that. Like, they are at the end. They actually show the final stage where you're going up against Draga. And I think Pac-Land is where this one ends. Which is kind of, you know, like, really taking you through... Oh, no, Dragon Buster. So you get the pre-Mario, and you get the pre-Zelda 2. And then from this point on, it becomes Nintendo dominating. But you kind of get, like, a great overview of some of the most influential and exciting and important arcade games of all time. I don't know what that was.
That was something.
Anyway, I put Namco Gal's Island on here just because it's a very different take than those historic documents. And then there was one other video. There we go.
Ooh, is this Galaxian 3?
Yes. So the one other thing that I find of value with these Laserdiscs is that they are actual acts of preservation for games that pretty much no longer exist. I just saw people talking on social media a few days ago about how someone somewhere in the States got a Galaxian...
Nashua, New Hampshire.
You got to go to New Hampshire to play this game. It's, I think, the only working Galaxian 3 in America, and there's like 5 known working machines in the world. But, you know, you can't actually play Galaxian without going to New Hampshire or Japan. But you can get this laser disc, and see the entire playthrough, 4-player playthrough, which is, you know, super wild. I believe the machine originally was called the theater mode, and it had 2 screens, kind of like a step down from Darius, but still respectable.
It's a huge machine, too. Like, it's a whole installation.
But I believe it's Laserdisc footage, and then it has, overlaid video graphics on top.
Same idea with, like, Silphied on the Sega CD.
And then just to bring things back around to Zevius, you have the Forgotten Zevius sequel, Solvalu, which was a first-person game... first-person shooter before 3D Plus G, or 3D G Plus, an arcade game where you could play Zevius in first-person mode. Not actually that great and exciting, but I've never seen one of these in real life. So being able to just buy a Laserdisc and see, hey, what was that about, is really valuable. So I have been ripping these to... Originally it was to 720p, but now I've been doing 4K because... Why the hell not?
Who's going to stop you?
Exactly. The police, maybe. But if they don't know about it, they can't stop me.
No one snitch.
Please. Yes, this is our secret, us and YouTube. But no, I've been posting these to my Patreon, but after a while they go up on the live feed for YouTube. So if you go check my channel, which is called, excitingly, Jeremy Parrish, these videos, there's a bunch of these that are up there, and I will go ahead and send another one of these, maybe two of them, live this weekend, just to kind of celebrate the occasion and get some of this stuff out there. But I have no idea how many of these videos exist in Japan. I have, you know, searches saved on Japanese auction sites and Mercari and so forth, and stuff will just pop up, and I'm like, oh, that's crazy. Okay, a how to use Mario Paint video? Why not? It's one of the few officially licensed Nintendo game videotapes. Like, they didn't really do that, but because that was co-created by Ape, I think Ape was kind of into it. So they put that out there, and it's just like, here's all the crazy little secrets in Mario Paint. Here's how to create Guernica in Mario Paint. It's, you know, just as esoteric as you want to get. It's really, really, I don't know. I love this stuff, and I keep finding more of it. And, you know, I do have a limited budget, but when I can afford this stuff, I love to watch it, rip it, and share it. And, you know, it's, I think, good to do that, because this is some genuinely valuable historical documentation of video game history. So it's like double history, and therefore doubly needs to be amplified and shared. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts from you, Kevin? It's just been me, once again, just totally dominating the talk with my videos.
I was going to say, this is really your baby. I'm here for color commentary. I do think these are really fascinating, and I think it is extremely helpful to sort of get a sense of what people at the time were thinking about these machines, or these games even, and how they were presenting them and promoting them in the case of a lot of these as well. I've never actually thought about how many of these may exist, and it's a little daunting now that you mention it, I gotta tell you.
Yeah, there are companies that really went deep into it, like Namco, Sega, especially Capcom also. Capcom had something called Capcom Friendly Club. It was like a fan club, and if you subscribed, they would send you a game tape, you know, like an actual, you know, like press content videotape showcasing their stuff at events, game previews, like walkthroughs of their studios. Like, there's interviews with Keiji Inafune and Kamiya and people like that from when they were babies. It's really great stuff. I still haven't gotten that online yet, but I will one of these days.
I know there's a tape that someone put online that's from Capcom, I think it's from Capcom, or someone working with Capcom, of just like one of these early Japanese Street Fighter tournaments. And it's like, it's not the full thing, but it's like a smattering of matches. And I'm sure, like, for someone really interested in the history of like the Japanese arcade scene, that's probably extremely valuable information.
Yeah, there's a video out there of how to play Star Soldier, and Master Takahashi is there, like, showing you his 16 shots and giving you pro tips and strats on how to play Star Soldier. It's really great. I love this stuff. If you own any of these tapes or laser discs, get them online. It's great. I love to see this stuff. So anyway, that's it. I just wanted to talk about how cool these are. Thanks for sitting here while I gush for half an hour. Thanks, Kevin, for balancing that out with your more measured personality. I appreciate it.
Giving you a chance to drink some water.
Yes, thank you. The book.